Interview Chair Darcy McGraw, Director of the Connecticut Innocence Project Post-Conviction Unit. We are talking about David Weinberg and the Joy Stockmell case. We had the Stockmell family in here. We had House Minority Leader Themis Claridis. And now we're getting the other side of the story. And we were talking about David Weinberg's trial before we went to break, and the fact that evidence was also analyzed by a gentleman who's considered the top forensic expert, one of the top forensic people in the world.
In the world, Henry Lee.
Dr. Henry Lee. And, Darcy, you want to address that issue, so go ahead.
I will be happy to address it. I am well aware of Dr. Lee's reputation. I come from the point of view that nobody is above the law and nobody is infallible. And that includes Dr. Lee. Dr. Lee testified in this case, and I am reading from page 27 of the trial transcript, that he tested reddish-colored crusts on a knife that was recovered from my client's apartment that was claimed by State's Attorney Connolly to be the murder weapon. He said that he tested the stains, that the reddish color stains, in fact, were blood, quote unquote. Then State's Attorney Connolly asked him, was there enough blood to determine the blood type? Now, you have to understand that.
And this was on the knife.
This is on the knife. And the same thing happened with respect to three hair fragments that were recovered from the trunk of my client's car. And those, in many ways, were much more damaging. And we can get into that if you'd like. But the important thing to know is that were this to happen today, there would be immediate DNA testing done on these minute amounts of, quote unquote, reddish crusts. But that technology was not available at the time of this trial. So that what they would do is they would first do a test to determine whether or not this was, quote, presumptive blood. Then,
now, what is presumptive blood? So if somebody's got a knife and there's red on it, it's not like somebody took a paintbrush and painted it
red.
No,
but it could be any number of other things. It could be, for example, animal blood, or if you were a person who fishes or hunts, or it could be dirt. It could be any number of things. It was a minute amount. But human blood has a particular protein in it, the human hemoglobin protein, and that is what tells you whether or not this is the blood of a human being. We have it, no other living thing has it. Okay? And that's why today the definitive test would be DNA testing. But at that time, what they would do is they would first determine, is this blood at all? And then they would go on and do a further test to see, can we tell the blood type,
so what was determined to be on that knife?
So presumptive blood doesn't even mean that it's blood.
It could be, as you said, dirt.
It could be anything. Then you go on to do the next level of testing. This is back, remember, in 19...
This was his knife, right?
This was his knife. There's no question about it. He carried a knife. He was a person who was an outdoors person. He worked on cars a lot. He did all of this.
And that's why he painted the wheels of his cars
red. Correct.
Right.
That's correct. The same thing happened with respect to the hairs. Now, as I read the transcript, and it's difficult because Dr. Lee has an accent, and sometimes he says hair, and sometimes he says hairs. But basically what happened was he took a group of hair and other material from inside of a wooden box in the trunk of the car and put them into an envelope. He then chose three tiny hair fragments, and by tiny I mean less than half an inch, and he determined that they too had these brown crusts on them. And he said that those were presumptive blood. Now, I, like you, read this testimony, and I thought, well, this is Henry Lee. He's saying that this is blood. It must be blood. Well, eventually, we found and carefully read the lab notes of the person who actually did do the testing.
Who did the testing?
A man by the name of Robert Mills.
What was his qualification?
He was a forensic serologist. He worked in the lab for many years. He had been in...
He worked under Dr. Lee?
Yes.
Okay.
And he had been in the military, I can't remember which branch, and he had done work in serology in the military. And we interviewed him, and we showed him the notes in his own handwriting. And he was able to show us that he definitively established that this was not human blood.
And Dr. Lee went against the advice of someone who worked under him?
Dr. Lee did not do the testing. Dr. Lee did not do this testing.
But didn't he testify? He seemed to testify opposite what
that's
that
correct.
Testing determined.
That's
why? Why would he do that?
Well, that's a good question. So, you can...
I mean, this is Dr. Lee we're talking about.
That's correct. So the question is, did he know what he was doing? Was he being careless? Was he biased? Had he come to a conclusion that this person was guilty?
Since 2010, have you tried to get in touch with Dr. Lee?
Yes, I have. I've written to Dr. Lee, and I've tried to talk to him about this case. As well, I know that State's Attorney Platt, who was my counterpart in the state on this case, has tried to talk to him about the case, and he has declined to do so. So therefore, the...
So contact has been made, and he's declined?
That's correct. And I would also like to say that this is not the only case where this very issue has occurred. Recently, there was a trial that took place in Rockville Superior Court of two individuals who many people believe are innocent, and Dr. Lee had testified at the underlying trial that there was blood on a towel in the bathroom, and it turned out that not only was it not blood, but he had never done the testing, and he testified at the underlying trial. He did the testing, and it was blood. And it's happened in other parts of the country as well. So
you mean to tell me, I'm listening to all of this, you mean to tell me that what you have just said about Dr. Lee...
Well, let's put it in basic terms. Is Dr. Lee all that he's hyped up to be?
I would take the position that Dr. Lee has made mistakes in several, if not many, cases, and that just because a person has a big reputation, it does not mean that he can't make mistakes.
Okay, well,
and he
up.
Might not make mistakes either, right?
He made a mistake in this case. And I am firmly convinced that without the knife and the hairs, this jury never would have convicted this man.
Okay.
I'm firmly convinced of
okay,
that.
Okay, let's hold those thoughts, Brad. We're coming up on... Traffic.
The best in the business. And I just cannot understand how our special guest here could have the...
Well, Brett, to be fair, Dr. Lee has come in for some criticism in the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Yes, I know that, too.
But now getting
and
back...
And the Phil Spector case.
Okay, getting back to the hair now. The hair that was found on the knife. Whose hair was it?
It was not found on the knife. It was found
in the trunk.
In the trunk
right.
of the car. So, just to make sure that we touch on all of the evidence that was excluded my client, Dr. Lee, at the time of the trial, testified about microscopic hair comparison of these three hair fragments that he selected from this envelope because they had these reddish-brown crusts. Well, at that time, that was sort of the standard way in which hair comparison was done. Unfortunately, we now know that it is not scientifically valid. And in fact, the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Innocence Project have entered into an agreement to do a complete review of cases involving microscopic hair comparison because there has been such a high error rate that has been detected. Now, literally what used to be done is the person, the examiner, would put the hair on a glass slide and he would look at it under a microscope. So there would be the sample hair from the, let's say, from the trunk of the car, and the known hair from the head of the deceased. And they would be mounted on glass slides and compared under a microscope. Well, we now know that what is quote-unquote consistent or similar to the human eye is not scientifically the same. We know out of, in 2015, when this project started with the FBI, DOJ, and the Innocence Project, the agreement was to review 3,000 cases. I know they did at least 500 cases by now. I'm not sure where they are at this point. But there was over a 90% error rate when actual DNA testing was done of the hairs that had been compared favorably by the examiner. So what that, and many of those cases, or at least a portion of those cases, included death row cases. So people had evidence introduced against them at their trial saying, this hair compares favorably with this hair, when in fact one had nothing to do with the other. And that's exactly what we had here.
Okay, we're running out of time here, so okay. I want to get some other questions in. First of all...
Let me just say one other word about the DNA, the fingernail scraping.
Okay.
We determined in late December 2013, there was a mixture of DNA underneath the victim's fingernails, and my client was excluded. He was excluded. I've heard this claim that because the body was in the water for days, the DNA was degraded, and therefore it's not reliable. That's not true. I would invite anybody to discuss this with Dr. Carl Ladd, who is the DNA specialist at the forensic lab.
Can DNA break down?
DNA, I don't know what is meant by breakdown.
Well, I mean, let's say you take a hair.
Yeah,
I mean,
the hair
over time.
Well,
can that break down and then...
So hair is a special thing because hair has mitochondrial DNA and it has... nuclear DNA only if the root is attached. In these hairs, the root was not attached. So we were talking about mitochondrial DNA. Underneath her fingernails, we were talking about nuclear DNA, skin, tissue, and blood. So, no, it did not break down. It was not degraded to the point where you could not get a valid reading of the chromosomes that were contained in that substance that was removed.
Did the victim put up a fight? Do we know?
Well, that was what John Connolly said. The victim put up a fight, and that's what Henry Lee said as well, that she had blood and tissue under her fingernails consistent with a fight. And by the way, my client didn't have a scratch on him.
When we had the Stockwell family in here, among the things they questioned, and I also saw it in the newspaper story, how come David, after this decision was reached, left the court through the back door rather than the front door?
I was just going to ask that one.
That was done at the suggestion of the state's attorney because the feeling was that there would be a large, angry group of people waiting in front of the building for us to come out, and the feeling was that we should go out the back door quietly, and we had to get special permission from the presiding judge to do so. That was done at the suggestion of the state. And while we're on the subject, and I know we're running short on time, I would like to say that State's Attorney Platt and I had many, many differences over this case, and they became quite heated. But she is known as a tough but fair prosecutor. She gave the family complete access to her file, and it was because she gave them such access and ability to resolve all their questions and concerns that it took nearly 5 months from the time we she and I reached the agreement until we made it into court.
Because the family has said, and they said on this program, that they were actually notified late in the process.
Well, that's what they said on the program right here.
They are taking the position that they should have been told back in 1997 when Mr. Weinberg's first habeas was filed. Now, I will leave that to others to discuss, because the issue of whether or not the family should be notified when a habeas is filed, obviously the defense attorney would not have an obligation to do that. That's not my place. I was never permitted to talk to them. It would have been, I think, much better if I had had an opportunity to sit down with them and present what I have presented here to you today.
Now, and again, we're running out of time. Was any arrangement made with David Weinberg in regards to, once he was released, being involved in social media? What kind of arrangement was
there? There was no arrangement made, and unfortunately, I tried to ignore and stay away from it. But I am well aware.
Why?
Yeah. Because I don't like reading horrible, nasty things about myself. But I am well aware of the fact that there is a Facebook page that threatening, terrible things are said about my client, and nasty things are said about me.
But my point is, I guess he has started a Facebook page.
He has not started a Facebook
page. He has not?
No, he hasn't. Somebody tried to contact him on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And we took care of that.
Because I'm sure you're aware the family is out there claiming that he has started the Facebook page.
That's what they claim.
I know that.
And it's not true.
Not true.
Okay. We have less than a minute left. Anything else you'd like to add, Darcy?
The only thing that I would add is that, unfortunately, this has taken on this life of trying to defeat good time credit. And risk reduction earned credit on the part of inmates. It absolutely had nothing to do with the resolution of this case. It was always understood that
this had nothing to do with good time credit.
Nothing, nothing. It was always understood he was going to receive a sentence of time served. And should the legislature enact this statute, and should the governor sign it, it will unleash thousands and thousands of habeas lawsuits on the part of the inmates who are affected.
Okay,
so,
we could explore that. And we know that Senator Susio is in the vanguard of that.
I would love to discuss that with them.
Oh.
Would you
do it on this show?
I would do it on this show.
There are people, though. I'm just saying there are people that I have talked with, and I talk with a lot of people, that there's a whole group that wants to let a lot of folks, okay, that are guilty, out of jail.
We'll save, Brad, we're out of time. We'll save that for another day. But I want to wrap up quickly, Darcy. In other words, Joy Stockmull's killer is still on the loose.
Absolutely.
Okay.
That says something. It is 8:30.